Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of What a Hell of a Way to Die. You've got me, you've got Nate, you've got Adrian. Gentlemen, how's everybody doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Pretty good.
Doing great. It's a beautiful, insanely muggy day in New York City, and I am behind air conditioning and closed windows.
That's perfect. So, speaking of hellish temperatures, let's talk about Afghanistan, a place that is known and loved by all three of us, I'm sure. Wonderful part. Now, where in Afghanistan were you guys at?
I was in Paktika province. I spent a little bit of time in Ghazni province, which is... So Paktika is not on the ring road. It's in the southeastern corner of the country. But it's got a spur road from the ring road, and then Ghazni is actually a province that the ring road goes through.
I was in Paktika province also, and I'm not going to repeat Nate's comments about it. And then I was in Kunduz province up on the border of Tajikistan in the north.
Okay. And I was based out of the Bagram Air Base, which is the main base there, and spent a lot of time up and down the Pakistani border in Jalalabad and Asadabad and a few places out there. Never went any further south than Kabul. So we're all spent a lot of time, and I was there in 2004. Nate, what year were you there?
I was in there 09 to 10.
Okay, and Adrian?
I was there 07, 08, and then again in 10, 11. So we've got a good chunk of the war covered between the three of us.
Yeah. I mean, for something that kicked off, that really kicked off in 2002, I believe.
Yeah,
we really... So the reason I want to bring this up is because if you haven't seen, we are sending at least at this point 4,000 troops back to Afghanistan because we... keep fucking dying in Afghanistan, as it turns out. We just recently, you know, recently it's green on blue stuff, which if you haven't, if you don't know what green on blue is, basically the American troops that are out there that are doing the training for the Afghan National Army, the Afghan police, you know, they're doing this training and then suddenly one of the trainees will turn their gun on the Americans in a surprise attack and generally ends up, you know, killing a couple because you're in very close proximity and there's already a little bit of trust built up there. So it's very obvious that we're getting that we're just going to go ahead and continue to dump money into this fucking hole of Afghanistan. So I wrote a piece about, and I'll post it up. It's called My Useless War, about how, you know, 2004 is when I was there. I'm the old head of the group here, at least when it comes to time in the military. And one of the most recent people that died in Afghanistan was a 22-year-old corporal who was 9 years old when I was in Afghanistan. So this ramp up again is really kind of hit me because we're obviously, I don't want to say that we're not done as if, you know, there is a done that can be, as if there's a finish. So I wanted to kind of get your guys' opinions on that. Nate, what do you got?
Well, I would say I'm similarly frustrated because I was in Afghanistan in 09-10 and a kid that I used to swim with, but who was much younger than me, he was probably fifth grade when I was a senior in high school, went to college, dropped out of college, enlisted in the military, deployed, and actually just got back from Afghanistan a couple of months ago. And so in a sense, like knowing that what I did or whatever we thought we accomplished was effectively either illusory or nonsensical in the time we were there even, but it certainly has been undone since then. It's frustrating to me because I don't think there's any way you can win the war in a sort of with a military solution. And I think that the people who know this the best, who know that it's the military solution is impossible, are people that are either veterans of that conflict or currently in the military, who have served there, and their voices are either are not being heard or they're too wedded to their own careers to be able to say in all honesty that it's useless. And somebody that I'm planning on interviewing for a bonus episode is a guy named Matthew Ho. He's a friend of mine, but he was a Marine officer in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then he served as a State Department provincial rep in Afghanistan. He quit. He resigned and wrote a resignation letter in 2009 saying, "This war will never end. There's no military solution." And it was this profoundly powerful letter, and it was ignored. And, you know, 8 years later, we're basically saying, oh, well, clearly we need to surge again to win. And I guess the thing that probably summarized it the best was what I retweeted this, but I feel like for our audience, we should just say it out loud. Thomas Gibbons Neff is a writer for the Washington Post, who's a Marine infantry vet. He interviewed, I want to say, a Marsov guy or someone who was a veteran of Marja, and he's a veteran of Marja too, which was the Marine sort of surge campaign in southern Afghanistan in 2010. And this guy said, oh, we're sending more people back to Afghanistan. Like, we should just saw off their legs and hit a few of them in the head with hammers back in the States, and it'll be a lot cheaper for the amount of good it's going to do. And that's a really brutal way of phrasing it, but I mean, it's also the truth. You will not change what's happening there without a political solution that I think cannot be forced. And but you will fuck up a lot of lives of young people, a lot of young Americans, a lot of young Afghans, a lot of Afghan civilians. And I guarantee you that if I go back to Paktika now, the cell phones are probably higher tech, but the same shit's happening.
And Adrian, where do you stand on this?
Yeah, I'm. It's interesting. I just by coincidence, I'm reading a book by a Belarusian Nobel Prize winner, Svetlana Alexievich. And she's written for years since the USSR times. One of the books she wrote was a series of kind of like Michael Hare's dispatches, interviews with Afghan veterans of, Ukrainian veterans, Ukrainian, Russian, and Belarusian veterans of their war in Afghanistan. It's called Zinky Boys. That's the American translation or the English translation. And it's about how that is the translation of the term for the coffins that were sent back without much explanation during the USSR's war in Afghanistan, these zinc coffins that you couldn't open. And it's really powerful. I've been talking to some Ukrainian veterans of Afghanistan here. Their experience is much closer to, I think, Vietnam veterans' experiences of Vietnam than our experiences of Afghanistan. They were very poorly resourced, and I mean, like, they weren't paid money. They were paid in scrip that they then traded. Like, they were selling some of their equipment in the marketplaces to Afghans, and then the Mujahideen would use them against them because they didn't have enough money to buy food. It was a really weird USSR type experience by all accounts. And the thing that really comes across, much like, I don't know what you guys think of Michael Hare's dispatches. I'm a huge fan, but it's just really powerful how the futility of it.
Yeah, and I think, and both of you will probably know a little bit more, because every military officer that I've ever come across is a historian in one way or another. But if you go back far enough with the wars in Afghanistan, so many people have tried to fuck with Afghanistan. And I don't understand why, other than it has a prime location, but the only thing you can grow there is opium. And roses. Like, there's nothing else that grows in the ground out there. Like,
well,
every time
wheat grows pretty well. Weed and wheat both start with W's, but they're both pretty powerful crops there.
Yeah, but I mean, you go back further and further. One of the books when I was in Afghanistan, I read the Flashman series, which, if you're not familiar with,
great.
The Flashman series is a British officer in Afghanistan who is kind of a dunce, but like super lucky and also really up his own ass. And they're really funny, but I mean, it still has that, you know, I mean, it's British colonialism of the 1900s that is still a massive failure. And the further and further back you go, people try to fuck with Afghanistan and nobody can do it because it's a bunch of guys who have been doing war their entire lives and their father's lives and their grandfather's lives. You go back far enough and you're just not going to run into anybody who's going to have any kind of success against the Afghans, unless you try to be nice to them, which I don't know why nobody seems to be able to do that.
Really, really quickly. So the author of the Flashman series also is a British veteran of World War II, and his memoirs are also very much worth a read. Really interesting.
I would just say too that there are historical periods in Afghanistan's history in which foreign occupying powers have managed to do decently well at controlling the country. But I think a lot of that has to do with soft power and a kind of co-opting of the local culture. The Mughals, the Indian Empire that ruled, I believe they were Indian Muslims, ruled Afghanistan and it were relatively successfully. A lot of Indian influence you can still see in Afghanistan as a result of that. But I think that the biggest problem that you face in Afghanistan across the board is that you have to ally yourself with someone in that country. And it's such a disparate grouping of people with a completely arbitrary border. I mean, the northern border is more based in reality because of the rivers, but the southern border is completely arbitrary, and it cuts the Pashtun homeland in half between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And so in a sense, you have to, if you're a foreign power trying to ally yourself with the Afghans to rule and to create sort of puppet states, or as the US says, build democracy, you have to find someone who's going to be your ally. And the problem is that that one person, unless you happen to find the one Afghan leader who's got sway with his people and lots of other people and other ethnic groups in that country, they're going to have powerful enemies. And they're probably going to have powerful enemies, and it's divided along ethnic lines. So, like, if you pick a Pashtun, which we did, then the Tajiks aren't going to trust him, and vice versa. Like, maybe you just pick a Hazara, and then everyone will hate him, and then, like, somehow that'll work. I don't know. But it's not a homogenous country.
Yeah. 2004, when I was there, there was still a lot of blue on blue, which was the Afghan warlords going after other Afghan warlords. We hadn't exactly united the country. And if you... The way that a lot of these Middle Eastern countries are set up, there's not a whole lot of central. I mean, there is a central government. There is a there are obviously borders and everything, but it's not the same as, you know, in America, where from California to New York, everybody is an American and we're all proud to be Americans. And, you know, people in New York obviously are different than people in LA, but we're all Americans, right? In Afghanistan, it, you know, is like, I'm a Kurd. I'm not really an Afghan. I'm Pashtun. I'm Dari. I'm, you know, there. And there's all these other, like, smaller groups. And yeah, I mean, the way that we went in to kind of help take over, well, not take over, to bring everybody into a centralized government was to give these warlords, hey, you guys can be a part of the central government. You can be a colonel, or we'll just pay you off and we'll, you know, get your troops and stuff. And it kind of worked. It kind of didn't. We're just basically waiting for the central government to collapse again and they all take over again.
One of the reasons for that, and this is something that bears very close watching as we begin our ramp up back into Afghanistan, we never had the sufficient combat power to occupy Afghanistan. That was a conversation we had about Iraq, you know, what the right number was. We've never really had that conversation about Afghanistan. We've had a series of numbers that were vastly too low, even according to coin theory, like Kilcullen's idea that, like, there should be a certain number of soldiers and a certain number of police officers for every part of the population. Like, we've never come anywhere close to even theoretically matching up with what could work. And so a lot of that had to be outsourced.
And one of the things that I noticed from being there was that the number of the physical area that we were expecting U.S. Army units to control was so massive and so unrealistic when you consider a 120-man infantry company is supposed to control, in my battalion's AO, anywhere from 3 to 6 districts. Those districts have tens of thousands of people in them, and they cover hundreds of square miles, or at least hundreds of square kilometers, let's be honest, an entire, you know, map sheet after map sheet, and you're supposed to patrol and maintain force protection and do all of the things that an infantry company is supposed to do in its, you know, sort of normal rotation. There's just no way you can have a permanent presence. And it's like, in retrospect, this sounds kind of cheesy because David Simon is kind of a dumbass online. But I wish I'd watched The Wire before I went to Afghanistan, because understanding why people have absolutely no reason to trust you or to confide in you when you can't provide even for the most basic security for them would have been a lesson that if I had watched that and gotten it through my skull before I went to Afghanistan, then I wouldn't have had to learn it the hard way, being frustrated by when we could not get buy-in. And the reason we couldn't get buy-in from locals was because there was no local force they could trust. The local police and military were imported from other parts of the country because the Afghans don't want to have Pashtun soldiers and police patrolling their, you know, the same neighborhoods, districts, and provinces they grew up in. So instead, you had Tajiks and Uzbeks and Turkmen police and army that don't speak Pashto that are patrolling an area, and no one trusts them. And the Americans are trying to play Boy Scouts and be nice to them, but no one trusts them either, because what they know is if you go out on a limb and you trust the occupying force or their you know, host nation forces, as soon as they go away back to their patrol base, everyone who's been watching you in the village comes out and cuts your fucking head off and burns your kalat down. That's just how it happens.
And sort of a corollary to that, the strategic extension of that tactical problem of going away, going home, which is something that we experienced in Vietnam as well, is that was the unit rotation, and that you had these units. And I'm not sure that units not rotating is necessarily the answer, but like the problem of units being deployed to country and staying there, the problems of that, which we experienced in Vietnam, has, I think at this point we can definitively say, not been solved by rotating units every 3 months if they're special operations, every 9 months if they're Marine Corps, every 12 to 15 to 18 months if they're Army. Like, that's not the answer either, and I'm not sure what is.
Yeah, one of the things that we really, I mean, in World War II, you had, you know, you showed up to the war and you were there until the war was done. Afghanistan, you know, you show up and you get a rapport with the people, and then you say, all right, I'm going to fuck off for now. And, you know, then the next people, they have to build up a whole new relationship. It's not as easy as saying, no, this guy is basically me, so, you know, it's fine. You trust him as much as you trust me.
Also, something I'd point out, and you can imagine me after 9 months of deployment just ranting and raving at people being, I mean, I feel like I yell enough as is, but I remember having this argument because the FOB owners of FOB Sharana, which my battalion was based out of FOB Sharana, I was based out of a smaller FOB nearby. The FOB owners were a brigade task force from like Mississippi, Arkansas, and Alabama, I believe. It was called Task Force Storm. I mean, they were country, like as country as it gets. And, you know, they had a number of NCOs who were men who wore ACU blouses meant for pregnant women because they were so obese. So it was one of those kinds of units. Now, they never went out the FOB. They never left the FOB. They made a cool guy video for themselves that went on AFN about Task Force Storm, you know, saving Afghanistan. It was filmed entirely on the FOB of them paving a road on the FOB. I mean, it was amazing. But I remember they did not want to share BDOC duties, on base defense operation cell duties. They didn't want their soldiers pulling guard shifts. They figured infantrymen could do that for them. But obviously, we couldn't go out on missions if we were pulling security all the time. They didn't want us to do it. They tried to negotiate a power, like a guard rotation sharing thing with Afghans so that there would be Afghan soldiers in the towers too. They didn't want that because literally, and I quote, one of their NCOs, actually it was one of their field grade officers, said in a sort of base-wide meeting, he said, now what happens when one of them rapes one of our women? I'm dead serious. Like, it was that bad. But the thing about it is, I finally snapped at one of their company XOs, who was a lieutenant like myself, because they had all these brand new vehicles they refused to lend us. They wouldn't let us take them on patrols, and our vehicles were getting blown up so much we didn't have any MRAPs to go around. We didn't have enough. The backfill on new MRAPs took so long, and we couldn't take our Humvees out because they said it was too dangerous. So here are these brand new vehicles with everything still basically in packing tape in a parking lot on the FOB, never being used. And I finally snapped at one of these this XO, and I said, like, you do realize, like, this isn't the fucking International Space Station. Like, you guys, we already proven that if you stay on a FOB for 12 months and you never go out, you will survive. Like, that's not the point. The point isn't to see, like, oh, can you make it if you never live? The point is, goddamn it, do missions. That's our job. But these people, I mean, like, you know, fat lieutenants with fucking pistol belts made out of leather, like, they don't care. They don't care. Their goal is to go home and to get deployment pay and, I don't know, fucking not pay taxes. Like, it was maddening, and I can't imagine it's gotten much better.
This is controversial, but green on blue, one of the things we started talking about on this episode is, again, describes when somebody from a host nation, blue is NATO allies, and green is NATO. No, blue is your forces in NATO, is U.S. forces on
green
a map.
Green is Afghan.
Green is Afghan or allied, I think. I think it's also just allied NATO. Like if we were fighting the Red Hordes back in the USSR times, like our forces would be in blue, but like the West German forces would have been green. Am I correct in that? Or
I think so, but I think that in the context of now, the attacks happen so often. It's Afghan soldiers against Americans, so yes. That like we don't really like if a Danish soldier freaked out and started shooting Americans on a FOB, then that would technically be a green on blue, but like that just hasn't happened yet.
Okay, so and I don't remember it being an issue in 2007, 2008 on my first deployment. This is not to say that it wasn't an issue, but it wasn't something that had captured like the imagination of kernels. So they were talking about it, and it definitely had by 2010, 2011, like it was a thing. And the hypothesis that I came up with based on observation, based on seeing some of those incidents, not being there, but sort of like understanding how things are. And this very much goes into what you were saying, Nate, about the occupying US forces. And also, unfortunately, a rejection of COIN. COIN was really never tested out. The haters will say that it was and that it failed, but I would say that it wasn't. One of the big problems is that you put a lot of people who really don't like Afghans down in a culture where you've got people who, it's basically an honor culture, a tribal culture. They're humans. They're not stupid. Like, they can pick up on it when somebody's saying like, you're dumb, do this different. And I think that that's, you know, yeah, like that has something to do with the green on blue incidents we've seen and will continue to see.
I mean, I agree in the sense that I don't think that anybody ever, it would be a rare occurrence if units had actually gone full COIN, in the sense that they were embedding at the smallest level possible and living in the districts, living in sub-districts, et cetera. Like, my battalion tried it, and it was more or less successful in a lot of ways. It certainly created space for, like, the Afghan government and military to go in and do things they had wanted to do. But most people are risk-averse because their careers aren't riding on them winning the war in Afghanistan. Their careers are riding on them not getting soldiers killed. So it's a war, but it's also an endless war that has become kind of a... you know, sort of, it's a cyclical thing that has its own norms. But something that I'd point out too, I totally agree with what you just said, and that is green on blues weren't a thing that had happened in Afghanistan to a great extent when I was there either. Not long after I left, you know, it started happening more often. But I would say this, I'm amazed they didn't happen earlier, with the extent to which people treat Afghans like dog shit, Afghan civilians, Afghan police, Afghan army, all the time. I had to escort some Afghan civilians off of Bagram. They were trying to get to Kabul. We couldn't get them on a flight to Kabul. So I escorted them on a flight from Sharana to Bagram. I needed to go to Bagram to look for a missing ANP who'd been shot in the head on election day. And his commander was a friend of my battalion commander's. And he was like, we need to find this guy and see what happened to him, because they don't know and no one had any info. And I had to fly with these guys from Sharana Airfield. It's like an hour flight by C-130 to Bagram Airfield, and then get them out the front gate of Bagram Airfield into Bagram City so they could drive to Kabul. And the drive from Kapisa Province to Kabul is not dangerous, or it wasn't back then. Whereas driving from Sharana, there are parts of the country where chances are very good you'd get stopped in a Taliban roadblock and killed. And we had a number of Afghan police who tried it on their own and got killed. So I had to get them through the main gates. And I realized as soon as we got off the air, I mean, first of all, we got on the plane and the Air Force guy started screaming at them about like, put your fucking phones down, shut your fucking phones off. And he looks at me and he sees I'm a lieutenant. He's like, sir, if any of them picks up a phone, I'm throwing them off the goddamn fucking plane in the air. And I was just like, brother, these are people, they work for the government. Like, what do you think? They're going on vacation for Ramadan. Like, you really think they're going to try to fucking 9/11 this plane? But like, whatever. Maybe I was naive. Anyway, so I get them to Bagram, and as soon as we get on Bagram, I realize, oh my God, there aren't any Afghans on this base who aren't supervised under armed guard. Like, I've got to get these guys. I cannot let them go on their own. And they first thing they start doing is milling around. And I'm like, guys, I had my interpreter. I'm like, guys, give me all your cell phones and cameras right now. We're going to put them in a bag, and I'm going to hold it. And do not, and like, sure enough, we get them on a bus. We get them to the main gate. I walk with them. I get told I'm not allowed to go out without armor, so I have to borrow an armor, ACH and a IBA or a IOTV. So I have to borrow one from like a female soldier. So like it's this tiny, look like I'm wearing like for, you know, equipment made for a doll. And I walk them. There's four interlocking gates, at which like four main gates and then like walkways. You basically, like, the rights of way are segregated, so you can only go in one direction through a couple of gates. Like, you can't turn around. And at each gate, they get searched. And like, when I get to them, like, there's always at the entry points, there's like somebody training at M240 Bravo on them. I mean, like, and I realized the further I got, I'm like, oh my God, if this is what it's like every day, like, how have they not burned this base to the ground yet? And finally, I get them out to the end. I hand them their bags back. Me and my interpreter go back through. You know, I get him through clear and everything. The next day in the daytime, when I take my interpreter out so he can go on vacation, I had to go through the main gate when they're actually searching all the daily workers. And like, it was literally something out of fucking Schindler's List, dude, the way they were treating people. They were screaming. They had all the men with their hands behind their head, basically like standing, getting searched. There's, I can't remember what it was I said or did, but like this Air Force E6 was like, sir, if you step in my fucking secure area, I'm calling the MPs on you. And I was just like watching this happen. I was like, this is literally Children of Men. I mean, I hadn't seen the movie yet at that point, but that's what it reminds me of. That's really what it reminded me of. And at the, I was like, when the green on blue things start happening, like in some ways, those are definitely, you know, insurgents infiltrating the forces, because it's not like there's a lot of background checks on people joining the military in Afghanistan. But also, you've got to admit that the way we fucking treat people in that country, it's amazing more people haven't gotten shot in the back whenever the, you know, the guys had a chance.
There was a brief analysis done of in the first year where green on blue became a problem. And I don't remember the number breakdown. We're not talking about a huge number of incidents here. It's like a handful of incidents, but there were enough of them to alarm people. And I think 25% of them were Taliban infiltrators. The other 75% of them were not. The other 75% were just like
people who
some
snapped.
Dude got pissed off. Yeah. Which was really, I mean, that opened my eyes pretty wide, and I haven't had the same experiences that you have, Nate, but I've seen enough similar behavior to understand that myself personally, like if I were on their side of things, I would be a lot angrier.
I mean, number one, I've seen there were blue on blue attacks when I was in Afghanistan. An American soldier freaked out and stabbed another American soldier in a base in, I want to say, Nangarhar province. I remember getting reported through Merc chat, but I had to another time. Here's the thing, right? I was running an outpost where, I mean, it wasn't like a Restrepo style thing. It was embedded with the Afghan government at their provincial headquarters. So in terms of it being like out there in the shit, it wasn't that, I mean, we were exposed in a way that an American FOB wouldn't be, because we had to rely on the Afghans to pull security versus American soldiers. But our base was adjacent to an American FOB. So if shit really got bad, we could find our way to the American FOB through a locked gate and get inside. But I was just around Afghans a lot. And so being myself and not wanting to have to constantly, you know, pull interpreters to ask somebody how to like fucking drink a glass of water, I started teaching myself Pashto. And I was by no means fluent, but I spoke it well enough to get basic information across. You know, even if it was literally just saying like malumat nishta, like I don't have any information, like I could say basic stuff. So our governor had to go to Kabul for a meeting, and our battalion said we had to send a soldier from the OCCP, from my outpost, to Kabul to be his escort. Because if he was going to fly on Blue Air or on, what is it? What did they call it? Presidential Airways or whatever the stuff was called, the Blackwater Aviation people. There had to be an American escorting him. So I wasn't going to send a fucking E3 to Kabul and get stuck out there. Like, because for one, he can't speak Pashto. For another, like if all it takes is a staff sergeant to fucking put him at parade rest, and who knows what's going to happen to our governor. And it's like, you know, to talk very crudely, if you're an idiot, Haji is Haji. The fact is, this is the governor of a province. So like, you can't let, like it's the entire relationship the battalion commander has in that province is predicated on this guy being treated with respect. So I had to be around him the whole time. And being a first lieutenant, you know, people were, even if they were uncomfortable, they weren't going to try to get in my face. So I fly with this guy to Parwan province, I think is what it was. It was Puli Alam, and then from Puli Alam to Kabul. So I get stuck on Kabul. There's no return flight at Kia, Kabul International Airport. And I realized that there's no, like, there's no SIPR phones. Nobody knows what SIPR is. I'm surrounded by foreigners. And I have to get to Camp Phoenix so I can get a flight home. So I go to Camp Phoenix. I'm stuck there. I have to go to BDOC every day and talk on their SIPR phone. And I get told, all right, you need to, since you're there, they're going to bring two ANP guys that are there for a conference. They're like colonels in the ANP, the Afghan National Police. Can you be their escort to fly them home? So I was like, sure. I talked to BDOC and I said, you know, what do I need to do to bring these guys on base? And they looked at me like I had the male genitalia growing out of my forehead. And literally at one point, the Afghans called me on a cell phone, and I spoke in very broken Pashto and just told them like, there's no flight today. I'll call you back when I have more information. And MI officer who worked in their TOC came out with her M4. And And I looked and they're like, she's like, I thought one of them got in here. And I was like, you motherfuckers. So I have to go out to the gate into like downtown Kabul, basically outside of Camp Phoenix, when these guys arrive and get them on base. And this is what happens. They get brought in. They get hand searched. They have to wear signs around their neck, big red signs that say no latrine privileges, no water privileges. And I have to guard them everywhere they go. And they're not allowed to eat. They're like eat American food. They're not allowed to go into the facilities. They're literally not supposed to even go into porta shitters. And so I take them to this Connex waiting area inside like the airfield at Camp Phoenix. And I'm like, there's no way these guys, like I can't let them go anywhere. I have to watch them. And finally, I'm able to get them on a flight and bring them home. And I don't speak Pashto well enough to have an advanced conversation, but one of these guys were just like, what the fuck? Like, do they think we're terrorists? But long story short, man, after having experienced that, I was so stunned and I was amazed that we didn't have more sort of revenge killings of Americans. And that was in 2009. I can only imagine with the green on blue stuff that it's gotten stricter.
So, and the other big piece of news about Afghanistan that came out is that the president has decided to, I don't know if we want to say wash his hands of it or just not even deal with it, but basically he's just saying, hey, Mattis, you deal with this. Now, I know a lot of soldiers, a lot of Marines especially, love General Mattis. Mattis has his problems, don't get me wrong, especially if you're not like if you don't get a massive erection every time you see an M2 or something, you know, there's problems with him. Now him being the guy in charge of Afghanistan, I don't know if that's good, bad. But I definitely think that it's in more experienced hands, but obviously with the 4,000 troops, going back over there, it's not exactly the solution I would have gone for. So how do you guys feel that Mattis is going to do now?
So to begin with, you know, I guess, you know, when you're developing a plan, the first thing you ask is like, what's the end state? You know, you do a timeline. That's the very first thing you do with a plan is you say like, you know, is this feasible? Is this something that you can accomplish? And how long is it therefore going to take to accomplish it? I don't even see that stuff. Like, I didn't even see that part of it. Like, so putting soldiers, 4,000 or 400,000, like 4 million, like what the fuck is the difference? Like what, give me a plan first and then we'll start figuring out how many people to put on there. This is crazy.
Yeah. I'm not even sure exactly what the goal in Afghanistan is anymore. Like there's always been this nebulous, end terrorism and have democracy, but that's not a thing. That's like, you know, saying it's a war on terror. You're fighting an idea. You're not fighting a person or a nation state or a government. So this 4,000 people who are coming up now who are going to be going to Afghanistan, what is the goal? I mean, seriously, somebody needs to have a goal set.
So I wanted at some point I convinced myself that I wanted to be like Lawrence of Arabia, but for Afghanistan. And I spent a lot of time. I mean, when I was in the SFQ course, I actually volunteered to have Pashto be my language. And I read a lot about Afghan history. And here's the one thing I'll say. Afghanistan has basically been at war with itself and with at war with modernity since the king was deposed in 1974. And when the Russians invaded, they actually invaded under the pretense that it was going to be a peacekeeping force to quell the insurrection that was taking place in the countryside, because the Pashto-speaking, Pashtun ethnic Afghan Communist Party had basically decided overnight to just ban Islam. And what they created was it was so poorly received that like government ministers, teachers, et cetera, were getting burned alive in villages. And so the whole point of what the Soviets called the limited contingent of Soviet forces was that it was meant to stabilize. It was meant to be a peacekeeping force. And when they invaded, if I'm not mistaken, they literally killed the president. Like I think it was Hafizullah Amin who had taken over from the previous incredibly unpopular communist premier. And the Soviets installed a guy that they thought they could trust, whose name was Babrak Karmal. And, maybe I'm wrong here. Maybe I'm thinking of, I've got the names. All I know is the Soviets installed a guy. The whole point was they were trying to stabilize the same way we were. And they fought this war. They held the cities. They couldn't hold the countryside just like we do. And then at the end, they left. The warlords fought each other. And Dr. Najibullah, who was the another guy they had installed, I think he became the president after Karmal. I'm not sure. I can't remember if my history is right. But Dr. Najibullah, this is what happened to him. The Taliban took over Kabul and they hanged him from a fucking tank barrel. And that's what would probably happen to Ashraf Ghani or Dr. Abdullah or Hamid Karzai if they could get their hands on him. But the fact is, Afghanistan was a complete fucking shit show and destroyed for a variety of reasons. But one of the main reasons was when the warlords fought each other, they rocketed and shelled the cities nonstop. That didn't happen under the Soviets. And the point of this diatribe here is that everyone who's been in Afghanistan since 1979 when the Soviets invaded has been there with the intention of stabilizing the domestic situation. They have not succeeded because they have not got, they do not have buy-in from the Afghan civilian populace. You had a huge brain drain of everyone who could get out, who did get out. And what we are describing, this end state that you just requested, Francis, if we were to actually put on paper what we want, we're trying to quell the insurrection of the Taliban and also Afghan ISIS, who is basically just another Afghan warlord group. And that goal, if you broke down the forces, you broke down the leaders of those forces that are fighting in it, would be almost identical to what the Soviets' goals were and to what you might have called a sort of stabilization idea post-Soviet withdrawal in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, when they were fighting their civil war. So long story short, the people we're fighting have been at war with each other since 5 years before the Soviets invaded.
So if we were to write a Vox or New York Times explainer piece about that, we might title it Afghanistan's Cultural Divide Between Rural and Urban Minus the Urban. Because they're actually, I mean, the cities aren't actually urban. They're basically rural cities.
And the idea of there being a sort of urban metropolitan elite, there was under the king from the 20s until the 70s, but those people all left. There was a time when Afghanistan was actually more developed and more advanced in terms of its infrastructure than India or Iran or even basically any Middle Eastern country besides Iraq or Kuwait. But whereas those countries advanced to some extent, Afghanistan basically blew all that shit up between 1974 and now.
Those people are all living in San Diego, San Francisco, Moscow, and Virginia.
New York, Virginia, New York, yeah. San Diego, Fremont, California, London, right. And Berlin, or actually, no, I take that back, Hamburg, because there was a huge amount of Afghan-German cooperation from the 20s until the 70s. There were actually a lot of German high schools in Afghanistan. I met people who've attended them or who did in the 60s and 70s. And so a significant number of, like, when you talk about asylum seekers in the EU, a lot of those people that are coming from Afghanistan are joining their family in Britain or in Germany because they came, you know, in earlier waves of migration.
All right. And I think that's a, you guys feel that's a good place to stop it at? I didn't really have any other questions for
you. Yeah. I mean, I think the best thing that could possibly happen, what I'd love to see, considering the way that we interact with readers, is we have probably more expertise in this group than we have on any other topic when it comes to Afghanistan. And if people have questions about Afghanistan, like the stuff that we take as a given because we know from experience, people might not know. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I encounter people who think that, like, when I say I was in Afghanistan, they're like, oh, you must speak Arabic pretty well. And I'm like, sadly, no. Like, so if people have questions specifically about Afghanistan, maybe we could do a not bullshit Vox explainer about Afghanistan and Afghan history. That might actually be pretty useful. And I might be able to get some actual fucking Afghans on the show, which would do a much better job than me.
Yeah, I feel we can probably get at least do one episode that's going to be all, you know, we'll just collect some questions about Afghanistan that people might have and have at least, you know, you two go at it. And then me just kind of like, I don't know, I didn't leave the base much if I could help it. I was that guy that was trying not to get shot in Afghanistan.
I would say that, you know, the things that I saw in Afghanistan between my experiences in the military and my experience liaising with the Afghans, meeting with Afghans, training Afghan soldiers and police and working with them on operations was really that's the basis and the foundation of my humanism personally. And politically, the idea of socialism, the idea that people could work together toward a common goal, very, very different people. I've seen it work. It just takes a lot of empathy and understanding. And you have to kind of get rid of your ego. You have to get over yourself. Those are things that the military they have the capability to do, but the military is not good at selecting and promoting people who demonstrate those abilities. You're lucky if you work with them, and you're not lucky when you work with the many who are not like that, who are very egotistical or narcissistic or career driven.
Yeah. So if you're out there and you've got questions, you can send a direct message to the podcast Twitter at Hell of a Way, or you can find us on Facebook. We do have the Facebook account if that's more your liking. Just shoot us some questions, and I guess if we collect up, a good 4 or 5 of them, then we can just dedicate an episode. Not like this episode isn't already dedicated to Afghanistan, but at least we'll be able to go more in depth on things that maybe you have questions about culturally, about the history of Afghanistan. I don't know how far back. I don't know if you guys want to go as far back as Alexander the Great, but I'm sure somebody can read a book about it.
Well, one more quick thought is just in terms of planning and expectations here. The idea that but we didn't totally address that. The idea that Trump would delegate this to Department of Defense or Mattis, that would delegate a geopolitically significant decision, is one of the most chicken shit things that I've seen from him so far. If you're a president, fucking own it. You're the boss. So you say, we're going into Afghanistan and we've got a plan to do whatever, to defeat whomever, to defeat the government, to defeat Taliban, ISIS, whatever you want to do. You own that. And then you go to the generals and you say, make a plan to do this. Hopefully you've talked to the generals beforehand. But this is really more evidence that Trump is, he's such a chicken shit, like shitty president. He's got no balls. He's a fucking coward. Worst president. I mean, like, I thought Obama was pretty lousy as a president. George W. Bush, obviously, even worse. But as presidents go, like, Trump just the garbage. I mean, like, more evidence of this dude's buffoonery, the fact that he's a fucking clown. Like, zero respect for that guy. By the way, I'm not calling him President Trump. We're just calling him Trump because the fucking dude's lousy.
And I was going to say, considering we have a massive right-wing following, Adrian, I think you have just convinced all of them that Trump is a piece of shit. So congratulations. But no, I agree with you. I think that's a point that if we could hammer home anything, I'm disappointed. I'm frustrated because, I mean, my sort of happening upon a leftist worldview and on anti-imperialism came from my experience in Afghanistan. But the decision to delegate this to the Department of Defense and to Mattis, to the CENTCOM commander or the, whatever the Afghan hierarchy, whatever that commander would be, combined joint task force, whatever. That's just basically, that is like the death knell of civilian control over the military in a lot of ways. And it's also proof in the utmost sense that there will be no solution to this. Like, there won't be a positive end. We won't win this war. We might not even get out of this war. Maybe they think deep down, like, well, we requisitioned Bagram Airfield for 99 years. We're just going to hold on to it. It'll be like Korea. But in a sense, every Afghan veteran is sort of waiting on that roof of the Saigon embassy moment. And it's like all they're doing is prolonging the inevitable. I don't know what's going to happen next, but I know we're not going to win because there's no way to win that war in a way that's socially, politically palatable to Americans.
Yeah. When it comes to putting the military in charge of something, we know how to do one thing. We know how to go in and smash and destroy and hold and occupy. Whether we're doing that well or not in Afghanistan is to be debated, but what we are not good at is peacekeeping. We are not good at nation building and saying, okay, now this is in the hands of the DOD. You guys do what you will. That's all we're going to do. We're not going to look for another solution. At least I don't think that we're going to.
Yeah, the closing thought I would say on that is that all of what we do of clear, hold, and build, all that we do of like various lines of effort, counterinsurgency, or just straight up force on force, fucking face smash operations, is meant to create the space in which the next step can take place in Afghanistan that has to be a political solution. And by cutting out politicians, by cutting out politics, by cutting out any kind of responsibility for, as the president or as the Republican Party or as the U.S. government, you are outside of the Department of Defense, you are basically admitting that there is no political solution. And so all we will continue to do is kill 16-year-olds in Afghanistan. They'll just keep getting, their years of birth will just keep getting further and further, into the 21st century. And similarly, killing 19, 20, 21, 25, 26-year-old Americans, whether they are corporals on their first deployment or, PFCs or, E7s who thought this was the last hitch before they got their retirement and now they're dead. Like, it's disgusting and tragic. And the fact is, it's a disservice to everybody who's in the military to say, we're going to let the military handle it. Because if there is no political solution, then you are consigning people to endless war.
For nothing.
And that drives me fucking batshit. But, I mean, Fluor and KBR will be banking, and so will Triple Canopy or whom the fuck else. And it's just, absent a political solution, nothing will change. And that frustrates me.
Yep. All right, everybody, on that cheery note, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to go to the Patreon page. $5 a month, you get access to all of our bonus content. If you haven't listened yet, we have one that just went up with myself and Matt Chrisman at Cushbomb from Chapo Trap House, talking about Top Gun, talking about Oiled Up, Maverick and Iceman, and that's pretty much, we just spend 40 minutes talking about the volleyball scene. Be sure to follow us. You can follow me at Army Strang. You can follow Nate at In These Deserts. And as always, I'm going to try it. I'm going to need to write it down. Presumptuous nominee. _nominee on Instagram, and see all the great things that Nate is doing, or that Adrian is doing out in the Ukraine. I hope Nate hasn't gone out to the Ukraine. It's going to make things a lot
not
more difficult.
Yet. No, not yet. But, you know, I have my eye set on a little chateau in the Carpathians that might get rolled over by Russian armored columns when the time comes. Yeah, also, shout out again to Carl Morand, our producer, who's awesome and has done great work for us. Thanks, Carl.
Yeah, everything is sounding much better now that we have somebody who knows what the hell that they're doing. And we're going to have Carl on at some point, too, because he is a former 11 Bang Bang, former Durin E5, right? Yeah, he's nodding at me.
Yeah.
An E5, so another enlisted person. So finally somebody I can give orders to. This would be great. Thanks for listening, everybody.